Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, it's Friday, December the 21st, and welcome to Newsdesk. Today, what next for Omar after the collapse of the landmark trial?
We know of no reason why there should not have been solid convictions. There's at least 10 people will be sitting at their Christmas dinner this year who were involved in the Omar bomb, and the intelligence service know these people.
We'll look at the failure of the police investigation, the questions about the people who ran it, and examine what went wrong with the forensics. We'll also hear about the latest atrocity in Pakistan. Our correspondent tells us why the bombers were happy to attack a mosque. And because it's almost Christmas, come with us to what some call the best carol concert in the world. But we start with the Omar bombing. Yesterday, as Sean Hoey, the only man to be charged with murder in connection with the atrocity, was cleared, there was a numbness. Today, there is rising anger among the families of those who died. There are massive questions, too, about the fate of Sir Ronnie Flanagan, the UK's Chief Inspector of Constabulary, whose stewardship of the Omar inquiry in his previous life as Chief Constable in Northern Ireland came in for such stinging criticism from the judge. Esther Adley is covering the issue for The Guardian, and I asked her whether people were surprised.
It wasn't a surprise in the sense that I think even the family members of the victims of Omar had expected that really the evidence was perhaps not quite strong enough to convict Sean Hoey. And before the verdict, I spoke to a number of them who said, we really think that he probably won't go down with the murders. What was a surprise was the strength of the comments made by the judge about the police investigation and the activities of other services, including the forensic service, and the force of his criticisms of that investigation.
So the families were surprised about just how bad the investigation was?
They had known some of the details, but to see it all laid out and to see really the case fall apart spectacularly before their eyes, on every plank of the prosecution case, the judge was very dismissive of the quality of the evidence. I think that was a surprise to the families and also interest to the police officers who were not expecting such a harsh criticism of the evidence that they had gathered.
The relatives must have been profoundly affected by that because they had placed so many hopes on this trial.
Well, I think it's probably fair to say this is the latest in many disappointments for the Omar families, who have consistently felt, I think, the inquiry was mishandled. There are a number of stages in the past, and don't forget this is 9 years ago now, where the investigation has been quite heavily criticised, most notably in 2001 when the police ombudsman Nuala O'Loan made a very strongly worded report into the police investigation. Obviously, I think the families were hopeful that something might have come from the trial and that they might secure a conviction, but As they were saying yesterday, this is really the end of the line for the judicial process for them now, and they are devastated by that, I think.
Who are they blaming specifically for this?
Well, they've been careful this morning to point out, of course, that the police were not responsible for the bombing, and it's the people who planted the bombing who are fundamentally responsible. But it's fair to say that there is a lot of anger directed at the initial inquiry conducted by, at the time, the Chief Constable of the RUC, Sir Ronnie Flanagan. He is now the Chief Inspector of Constabulary for the National British Police Forces, reporting to the Home Office, so has a very senior job, but was very strongly criticised by one of the victims' families yesterday.
It's the appalling inefficiency of Sir Ronnie Flanagan and the initial investigation that has meant that Chief Superintendent Norman Baxter has not been able to secure a conviction.
Now, Flanagan's position's untenable, isn't it?
Well, certainly there's very strongly growing pressure on him now. Sean Woodward, who is the Northern Ireland Secretary, has said that he will be reviewing the case in the light of the judge's criticisms. And there is pressure growing, obviously, on Sir Ronnie's position. He has said nothing so far, and we will wait to see what happens. The Northern Ireland Policing Board is hoping to meet with Sir Hugh Orde, the current Police Service Northern Ireland Chief Constable, and there are human rights bodies north and south of the border are both calling very strongly for this judicial inquiry. But as for Sir Ronnie's position, we'll wait and see.
So what happens next? The families have talked about the need for a public inquiry. How do they go about getting that?
Well, the call for public inquiry north and south of the border has been described as unprecedented. There are so many failings, as the family see it and as critics see it, about this process, both in the run-up to the bombing, when the families believe warnings were ignored that, potentially could have averted the problem, averted the bombing, to, as we have seen, the difficulties and failures in the investigation following it. So they will be leaning very strongly on the authorities for this public inquiry, and Sean Woodward will be responsible for calling that if that happens. The families are also pursuing at present a civil case against five men who they named as having been responsible. Sean Hoey is not among those five men. And they have said now that that is really the only option available to them, and they will definitely be pursuing that. Whether or not they will get any satisfaction from that legal process, we have to wait and see.
That's Esther Adley in Belfast. Now, one of the most serious issues arising from the collapsed trial is the failure of forensics. Officers failed to wear the proper clothing while collecting evidence. Labels routinely fell off items. But the most serious problem was a reliance on the low copy number DNA testing, a British technique that should have allowed experts to reap evidence from the most minute sample. The judge rubbished the way it was employed. So what's the future for it now? Our science correspondent Ian Sample is with me. Ian, what is low copy number testing?
Well, it's a technique that the Forensic Science Service uses to get DNA profiles out of very, very small DNA samples. So you can have microscopic amounts of material that someone's left over, say, from a fingerprint on a glass or something like that. And you can just have one or two cells, and you use this technique to basically amplify up, you photocopy up all the material, and then you can try and get a DNA profile from it.
So from what we know, what went wrong with it here?
Always the problem with this low copy number technique has been contamination. Because you're starting with something very, very tiny and you're just photocopying it up, if there's any other contamination, and you know, when you're out in the field, if you pick something up off the floor, there's going to be all manner of things all over it. Contamination is a big thing. You amplify up all the other people's DNA. And if you, you know, if you're looking in cars that have been rented, or if you're, or just any other kind of product you can think of, it's normally been through a few people's hands. And so contamination can happen all the time. And it's a key reason that you have to keep the labs completely sterile. When you take the forensic stuff, you have to be very, very careful about how you do that.
The judge was scathing about how it was used in this case. Can it be used again?
I don't doubt that it will be used again. The problem is to not have your case reliant on it completely. I mean, it seems in this case maybe there was an over-reliance of this low copy number technique as being there the prosecution's case. You need to have really all the other evidence in place and then use something like low copy number as the sort of nail in the coffin rather than the other way around.
In some countries and in some elements of the criminal justice system here, they don't like it, do they?
No. There are major labs which are very sceptical about this technique. The former lab of the government chemist is very sceptical about it. The Forensic Science Service in Ireland won't use it. It's too ambiguous. So it is a technique that has to be used with an awful lot of caution.
Just lastly, what will happen now? Will there be a process whereby people go away and we'll have to reevaluate this test and the value of it?
I wonder, because I think the Forensic Science Service, they do say that, you know, you have to be very careful with this technique and you have to be more cautious in interpreting the information from this technique than in normal DNA profiling. So it may be that it's more for the judicial system to have a look at how it uses this information rather than the technique itself. But you have to think that maybe they have to strengthen that warning.
Thanks, Ian. And you can keep up to date on that story throughout the day on our website. Also on guardian.co.uk today, expect gridlock in many areas of Britain as 25 million people set out for a Christmas break. There's trouble at the airports too, where workers have announced plans to strike in the new year. You can see that on guardian.co.uk/travel. And just how rich is President Putin? The Guardian has learned of a power battle within the Kremlin, which has thrown up claims that Putin has oil and gas holdings enough to make him the richest man in Europe. That's on guardian.co.uk/Russia. No Met officers will face disciplinary action over the shooting of Jean-Charles de Menezes. That's the verdict from the Independent Police Complaints Commission today. More on that at guardian.co.uk/news. Another law and immigration row, as the government says it has no interest in deporting thousands of foreign prisoners who've only served short sentences. The Tories say it makes a mockery of claims that Gordon Brown was going to get tough. That's on guardian.co.uk/immigration. And the rain's the dominant factor in Sri Lanka, where England are chasing 418 runs to avoid defeat in the third test. You can find ball-by-ball coverage on guardian.co.uk/sport. There's been another tragedy in Pakistan, where a suicide bomber has exploded a bomb in a mosque, killing themselves and at least 35 others. Reports say he sat in the front row at the mosque in Shapal, a village 12 miles from the city of Peshawar, and began to pray before exploding the device. I spoke to Randeep Ramesh, our Southeast Asia correspondent, and I asked him what the reaction has been.
Well, there's been a very strong reaction in Pakistan to the bombing, partly because President Musharraf has staked so much on improving the security situation in the country. That was his justification for lifting emergency rule. He said he'd roll back the tide of militancy. The response has been fairly devastating from the militant side, and this is just the latest in a string of attacks by suicide bombers in Pakistan. I think we're counting now the seventh suicide bomber in the last 2 weeks.
And why this mosque?
Well, I suspect, although it's not clear from the reports, and I haven't visited his family home, the interior minister is probably... Has a large and sprawling compound in this area, northwest frontier province, and Chasada. And that mosque was probably his family mosque because it was inside the compound. So the militants have got their propaganda value because they're targeting his family. Now, he's been quite vocal. He was quite vocal as the interior minister, that's basically the home minister, in the previous military government, and he'd been quite vocal about chasing and pursuing and hunting down militants. And back in April, a suicide bomber rammed a public rally in which he was addressing, killing, I think, about 30 people at the time. So he's been on their target list, and the mosque is probably a personal, sentimental thing for the former interior minister, and they've gone for it.
One would have thought their security would be extraordinary.
Well, it's election season, and parliamentary attacks during election season are not unknown, and the best security in the world has not saved people like former Prime Minister Shoukat Aziz, who on the election trail a couple of years ago was targeted by a suicide bomber. It's not saved President Musharraf, whose own cavalcade was attacked a couple of Decembers ago. So I think, you know, Pakistani security, however tight it is, has been infiltrated. And in this case... One of the followers to the mosque, one of the worshippers, turned out to be the suicide bomber. He simply placed himself, according to Pakistani television and reports, in the front row of the mosque, started to pray, and then detonated the bomb.
But doesn't an attack like this cause just such revulsion as to negate any benefits that the attackers might actually get?
Well, I think that the struggle for the soul of Pakistan is probably a greater prize for these militants than the niceties of religion, if you like. They have in the past attacked mosque gatherings. They, depending on their religious colouring, they will attack Shias or Sunnis, different sects in Islam. I don't think there's anything off limits because they're really, their prize is control of the Pakistani state and toppling what they call a dictatorship of the military or President Musharraf. So unfortunately, that I don't think there's many religious niceties that they or pieties that they're willing to observe. I mean, they're prepared to kill people.
That's Randeep Ramesh. And coming up on this edition of News Desk, the Angels of the Amazon. We talk to the doctors who risk their lives to save others in a remote corner of the world, and how to secure a Damien Hirst for just a quid.
I'm delighted that you do that, because it's a great gallery, but I'm even more delighted that someone who brings their kids to the art gallery has won the Damien Hirst sketch. We will be in touch, and many, many congratulations.
I'm Matt Wells on the latest Media Talk podcast, Ofcom Say and Channel 4 Pays. Can the broadcaster draw a line under its troubled year after a £1.5 million fine over those faked phone-ins? And troubles in Podland. We ask what's next for Danny Baker after he pulls the plug on his internet comedy shows. Plus, another X Factor voting row and Radio 1's row over the Pogues. It's all in the new Media Talk at guardian.co.uk/podcasts.
Roz is here now with a look at the papers. And what are the papers saying about Omar?
There's a lot of disgust, really, in the editorials today in The Guardian, The Times, about the way this case was handled. The Times says it was a shocking state of affairs that these police officers basically lied to try and make their evidence appear more credible. And The Guardian agrees. The Mail is also very exercised about this case because it's run a campaign to raise money so that the victims' families can bring a civil action next year against five suspects. Yeah, it is. Of course, it's the kind of thing that the Mail tends to get involved in this way. You may recall Stephen Lawrence. Sometimes when it gets involved in a case like this, it doesn't let go, and that's certainly the case here.
And Guantanamo, we covered that on the programme yesterday. What are the papers saying about the release of those prisoners from Guantanamo?
Well, there are quite a lot of people who wish that they'd never been released at all, as far as I can tell. I can quote John Gaunt, the Sun's new Richard Littlejohn, more Richard Littlejohn than Richard Littlejohn, if I can put him that way. "I don't give a flying toss about them," he says. And the Telegraph makes a similar point in slightly more civilised language. He says these guys are accused of having links to Al-Qaeda. They're not British citizens, they're only British residents. Why should this trio be Britain's responsibility at all? And as far as we can tell, they just hope that two of them, one has already been released, of course, gets extradited to Spain as soon as possible. We also learn that the actress Vanessa Redgrave was one of the people who helped put up the bail for Jamil El-Banna, who appears on several of the pages with his very, very long grey and white beard stretching all the way down his jacket. He was heading home, of course, yesterday to see his youngest daughter, whom he's never met because she's 5 years old, and his wife was pregnant at the time when he was picked up and sent to Guantanamo.
No chance that the Daily Mail will also sponsor them.
Oddly enough, the Daily Mail isn't very interested in the Guantanamo Bay story today.
There's money worries at the Treasury.
Big money worries, according to the FT. It says economists described the Treasury's budget figures yesterday as the worst ever for this point in the financial year. Call them ugly and shocking. When economists use terms like that, you know they must mean it. One of the big reasons for this is that the Treasury has had to put off a number of privatisations because of the state of the financial markets. Basically, if they wanted to float a uranium enrichment company and a venture capital fund and hope to raise billions from that, and also Scottish Water, but the SNP's election in Scotland put paid to that one. So, yes, it's not going to be a very cheerful Christmas in the Treasury, if indeed it ever was. And the last story today, which I really feel I should just cheer everyone up a bit, it concerns a pigeon. This pigeon is called Pokey, and it belongs to a chartered accountant called Andy, 42. It's in the Sun, and Pokey turned up on Andy's doorstep, and Andy couldn't resist her charms. But unfortunately, Pokey has developed an attachment to Andy, which Andy's wife, Trudy, finds more than a little distressing. I'll just quote Andy here. "When Pokey is on her mating cycle and lays her eggs on her little bed in the bathroom," I'll just pause to let you consider that prospect, "she sits on them for 3 weeks, but when that part of the cycle is over and she wants a mate, she comes after me and harasses me. She will fly over for me to caress her beak, peck my fingers and strut about puffing up her chest to deter females. If Trude comes near me, she will fly at her head and peck her. She is overcome with jealousy." Trude tells the paper that she will be happy to see her in a pigeon pie.
I'm being quiet here because I'm just dabbing my eyes. That's really quite emotional.
Yeah. The Sun has spoken to a Swiss pigeon expert whose name is Professor Daniel Haag Wackernagel, who says this kind of behaviour is entirely normal in a pigeon that has developed this kind of bonding with a human being rather than with another pigeon.
And for more of today's papers, you could look at theguardian.co.uk/wrap. Now, the name's innocuous enough. What would you expect from Brazil's national airmail service but a few letters? In fact, it's the title given to a group of army medics who fly thousands of miles to care for the sick in the most remote areas of the country. Tom Phillips went to meet them.
They are known as the Angels of the Amazon, and deep in the world's largest tropical rainforest, it's not hard to see why. Hospitals are few and far between in the backlands of the Brazilian jungle, and when medical care is available, it often comes in the form of Brazil's national airmail service. The Amazon postmen do not send letters, and they don't deliver Christmas gifts. Instead, they are a group of airborne medics who risk life and limb bringing healthcare to some of the most remote corners of Brazil. Every month, the flying doctors set off from the military airport in Manaus and head to Amazonian river communities or isolated indigenous reserves. For many of their patients, the airmail missions are the only direct contact with the Brazilian state. The latest airmail mission was headed by Colonel José Volkmer, a dashing former fighter pilot who has served as a UN military observer in Sarajevo. Alongside 9 Air Force doctors and nurses, the group set off in October for 3 indigenous villages in the Amazon state of Roraima.
O Brasil tem uma dimensão continental. Isso é uma coisa muito grande, né? Nós aqui só na Amazônia são 8.500 quilômetros de fronteira.
Brazil is a continent-sized country. It's very big. Here in the Amazon alone, there are 8,500 kilometers of border. It is a huge area to control, and we have to populate it. Naturally, this is done by the indigenous communities. They occupy this place. We have a few border outposts, and we have to increase the number of runways here. The planes and their wings allow us to get to such remote places, which are always very needy.
Bom, nós começamos o atendimento faz aproximadamente 3 horas. A mim ficaram mais as gestantes, né? E mulheres por conta.
We started attending patients around 3 hours ago and have been seeing mostly pregnant women. The female doctors are doing it because these women generally feel less ashamed about showing gynecological problems to me. The problem here is the language. It's hard to get as many details from the patients. But in general, it's going well. I've seen a lot of expectant mothers, all of them girls between 13 and 14 years old, and it's their first or second child. They start their reproductive lives very early around here.
The airmail missions are not just about humanitarian work, however. The Brazilian Air Force also uses these journeys to gather intelligence on the remote areas around Brazil's border with Guyana, Venezuela, and Colombia, the world's largest producer of cocaine. Whatever the motives, residents of Caramambatay, an indigenous village near the border with Venezuela and Guyana, are grateful that the Air Force are coming. Earlier this year, Fidel was bitten by a deadly surucucu snake. On the verge of a coma, he was evacuated to a hospital on board an Air Force plane.
What was the health situation like before they came?
The health situation before was very, very hard. Very, very hard. When there is no medicine to cure, a snake bite kills you. Before a long time, people died, old people, ancient people died before. And right now, the modern people like us, we are with these kind of people are helping us very much. We are thankful about that also.
Destacamento! Fora de fora! Mas! Amazônia! Caramambatay! Brasil!
Tom Phillips there with Brazil's army medics. So we know the lengths people will go to get their hands on works of art. Fraud, subterfuge, elaborate robberies. So what are we to make of Mohammed Khan, a teacher from Bradford, who obtained a Damien Hirst original for £1? The news was broken to him over the phone at a presentation last night, and our North of England correspondent Martin Wainwright was there.
It's a chilly afternoon in Leeds, but there are quite a lot of people braving the cold to hear the result of the great Damien Hirst raffle. This was an enterprise by Leeds City Art Gallery to get more people to come here and see all the improvements and restoration and stuff that's gone on. And the way they've done it is by taking a sketch by Damien Hirst, which is one of his trademark sharks and a skull and crossbones done on the catalogue of an exhibition of his in Naples in Italy a couple of years ago. And he's donated this. Damien Hirst has given it to Leeds City Art Gallery, and it's been raffled. You've had to pay £1 per ticket, but one of the conditions is that in order to buy a ticket, you've had to come to Leeds and to the art gallery to buy the ticket. So it's had this double role.
If you can just about hear us, we will be in touch with you very shortly to arrange for you to come and pick up the Hirst sketch.
And I'm just catching Geoffrey Sherwin, who is the man behind this. Geoffrey, I know you're a busy man, but how do you feel now? It's gone to a Leeds lad who teaches in Bradford.
Absolutely delighted. I'm delighted especially because he brings his family to the art gallery regularly on a Sunday.
Oh, does he? As a regular thing?
Yes. He brings his family here. He bought a lot of tickets, bought 50 tickets, which means he was happy to lose his money. if lose it is, for a good cause.
It's a good cause because it's going to Heart...
Heart Research UK, yes.
Yes. You had some quite illustrious ticket buyers.
The Minister of Culture, Margaret Hodge, when she came to Leeds, also bought £5 for the tickets.
Oh, did she?
But not the Lord Lieutenant. I thought she was going to buy one on behalf of the Queen, but she didn't.
Well, I think she came here a little bit too late. It had closed.
On Football Weekly Extra, the year is going out with a bang, with a weekend of big, big matches awaiting us right across Europe. In the Premier League, Arsenal have a derby date with Spurs, and Everton will be at Old Trafford taking on Man United. In Spain, there's the Superclásico, Barcelona-Real Madrid. In Italy, the champions of Italy, Inter, face the champions of the world, Milan, in the Milan derby, while there's fresh news about the return of Luciano Moggi. And we've got Rafa in for crisis talks again. That's Raphael Honigstein explaining why the high street's not the only place they're having a Bayern meltdown. All that in Football Weekly Extra. For details, go to guardian.co.uk/podcast.
So just 4 days to go to the big day now, and three until something very special happens in Cambridge. The Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols has been broadcast from the chapel at King's College, Cambridge, for every year but one since 1928. It begins with the voice of a single boy treble, who isn't selected for the task until seconds before the broadcast. Magic, drama, the event has got it all.
For many people, Christmas doesn't properly get underway until they've heard this sound. Every year bar one since 1928, a service of nine lessons and carols has been broadcast on Christmas Eve afternoon from King's College, Cambridge. And it always begins with a lone treble breaking the silence in the first verse of Once in Royal David City. Countless millions in the United Kingdom and around the world tune in. It is a live broadcast, and in order to take some of the pressure off the individual, a squad of boys is prepared for the solo, as Stephen Clebury, fellow organist and director of music at King's College, explains.
We actually don't identify to the boy himself who's going to sing it until the BBC's red light starts flashing. And that's a system I inherited from my predecessors, and it served me very well because I think it prevents one individual getting really stewed up for 10 days or a fortnight beforehand. But I always make sure that we've got something between four and half a dozen who are, in a sense, papabile, that I know and am confident could do it. So I think I'm pretty confident that we're always going to have a soloist.
Stephen Clebury has been director of music at King's since 1982. This year we'll see his 26th nine lesson service. Does he still actually like carols?
I do. Of course, there are many different kinds of carols, and on the whole, I tend to perform, obviously, those that I like. And that means anything from medieval carols right through to newly commissioned ones, with a lot of the well-known ones taken in along the way.
Although the King's service is the model for carol services across the world, the college did not invent the form. That honour, apparently, goes to Truro in Cornwall, where the first formal service of lessons and carols was held in 1880. The King's tradition began in 1918, 10 years before the first annual broadcast, so next year will be the 90th anniversary. What is its importance?
Well, for the church, Christmas, along with Easter, is one of the two major liturgical festivals. And for me, I think the value is that we are representing this story each year in a way which combines old and new. And from a point of view of, almost you might say, from an anthropological point of view, this is quite important because things that are important to people are often expressed through some kind of ritual, be it the changing of the guard or the cup final or the opening of Parliament, whatever it is. So it is, in a sense, a kind of ritual, but in my view, not less valuable because it is.
In fact, preparing the actual performance is not so taxing as putting together the programme.
Many Christmas carols are, of course, from the point of view of learning notes, a great deal easier and more straightforward than a lot of the other repertoire we sing, although some of the commissioned carols have been quite taxing in that respect, so I'm always glad to have that copy of the new music well in advance, and then I can try to assess its difficulty and start learning it at an appropriate time. Then again, of course, we have some concerts. For example, we've just been in Brazil for a week giving concerts, in some of which we've included some Christmas carols. So that gives some performance experience of these pieces, but yet you've somehow got to make sure that the wine comes to its full maturity, if I could use that analogy, at 3 o'clock on Christmas Eve in the afternoon. Just comes up to the boil at the right time.
A very festive Peter Kingston with that report. And remember, there are lots of Christmas goodies on the podcast page of our website between now and the new year. We have a special on Katine, the Ugandan village The Guardian is helping to develop as part of our three-year project. Plus, we have a Cut Out and Keep podcast, a guide to the US presidential elections. And all the usual reviews of the year from music, media and our Guardian weekly teams. Plenty to put on your shiny new iPod. But that's it for this edition of Newsdesk. The producer today was Andy Duckworth. I'm Hugh Muir. Have a great break and goodbye. Guardian Unlimited.